Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time to take our usual deep dive into the news of the last couple of weeks. With me is our National Director, John Stevens. Good morning, John.
Hi, Phil. Nice to see you.
Adrian's still on holiday, so it is just the two of us today. One place to start, really, and that is Wagatha Christie coming out at midday today. The Mrs. Vardy and Mrs. Rooney, and I'm joking, John, I'm not going to start there. You weren't expecting that. We're going to go with the Tory leadership debate.
It's really interesting. I don't know where it's going to go because it has not been announced yet.
Midday today, isn't it?
It is fascinating that two people want to spend £1 million each on legal fees in order to vindicate their reputation.
Indeed.
Which I think is really interesting that people are so concerned about that.
Well, we shall see where that goes. John, that was just to throw you a curveball. You dealt with it brilliantly. The Tory leadership debate then, Rishi or Liz? Who's it going to be, John?
Well, I think all the evidence suggests it's going to be Liz, who's our next Prime Minister. She seems to have the overwhelming support of the Tory party kind of membership. I think that's both because of some of the policies that she's advocating. She's saying what they want to hear. It's also because she's not perceived as someone who turned against Boris Johnson. And I think in many ways, Sunak is kind of seen as the perpetrator of a coup that overthrew Johnson as Prime Minister. And I think within the party membership of the Conservative Party, the 160,000 people who are going to vote for the next leader and our next Prime Minister, many of them become members after the 2019 election. I think it's pretty clear that Liz Truss is going to be our next Prime Minister. But it's fascinating watching them make their case, because at one level, they are appealing not to the wider public, but to this very small electorate of predominantly older, predominantly male members of the Conservative Party. And at one level, there seems something of an unreality about the discussion as they're kind of channeling Mrs. Thatcher or Ronald Reagan for the policies they want to adopt. And I think it is just a revelation of the reality of politics, that you have to appeal to the audience that are going to vote for you. So I think what we don't really know is exactly what they will do when they come into office. What's clear is there are absolutely massive challenges that we're facing as a nation. I think the cost of living crisis is an immense challenge. And it's pretty difficult to know, I think, at this point, what either of them will really be able to do when they get into office, and whether reality enables them to do the things that they're saying they'll do to win over the votes of the Conservative Party kind of membership.
We'll get to the cost of living in a minute, because I want to spend some time talking about that. But before we get there, this doesn't, I think, look great for democracy. So I know that we don't elect presidents, we elect parties, and I understand that. So the Conservative Party got the mandate in the election in 2019. But this just looks like a very small proportion of the country voting for the person who will lead the country. It doesn't look like democracy, John.
You might say that, but actually democracy within the UK is kind of a slightly different model. We don't have directly elected presidents. Instead, what we do is we elect a parliament, and the person who serves as prime minister is the one who's able to command a majority of the House of Commons, which in essence means they can command a sort of a majority of the members of their MPs who are backing them. So in some ways, this is our system operating in the way that it's meant to operate. Boris Johnson was removed because in the end he lost the support of the sort of majority of the Conservative MPs, and he could no longer command a majority in the House of Commons. Those MPs have now put two candidates forwards. I think the thing we don't know is which would the MPs support if they voted alone. So the final voting of the Conservative MPs was between the three candidates. Now, they've not voted between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. I suspect the majority would probably vote for Liz Truss. So in some ways, you might say this is exactly how our democracy kind of works, that we're not so personality focused. And in some ways, one of the interesting features of British politics over recent years has been an attempt to bolt a personality politics on this representative system, which you see to some extent in Tony Blair with a more presidential model of leadership, and particularly with Boris Johnson, who is elected because of his personal charisma. He didn't, in fact, have a massive amount of personal support amongst MPs, but because of who he is and because of the popular public support, he had an almost quasi-presidential kind of position. So I'm not sure it's necessarily the case that it's not democracy working. It's actually how our democracy sort of works. And I think the big kind of weakness, and I think we've said this before, is actually the collapse of party membership. So what's extraordinary is compared to the 1950s, when the parties, both Labour and the Conservatives, had millions of members, that is now reduced to 160,000 people. It's a tiny number of people are actually actively involved in kind of the political process and making that decision. And of course, until recently, it wasn't the members who chose the prime minister. It was exclusively decided by the MPs who were working with and sort of saw the person operating in that context.
Well, it looks a bit like the Conservatives are navel-gazing while there is a massive crisis coming on the horizon. Now, I'm talking about cost of living. I think that's one of the things that is standing out this week, to me at least. While the Conservatives are having this internal dialogue, basically, about who the next leader will be, it's like coming over the horizon is this horrendous cost of living crisis, that the costs of gas and electricity are going through the roof and will go through the roof again, particularly just as winter hits. I think the consumer champion, Martin Lewis, he was extraordinary on Radio 4, basically saying millions are going to be in fuel poverty. How do we respond to this? It just looks like they're interested only in electing a leader and not thinking about these horrors that are coming for ordinary people across the country.
Can I just make a comment about the election first, and I'll come on to that? I think actually just for us as Christians, actually one of the lessons of the Conservative election campaign and what's happening at the moment and the hustings and everything is just a warning to us of the danger of falling into saying what we think people want to hear rather than speaking the gospel. I do think that, you know, appealing to this small electorate of 160,000 people are forced to, in a sense, say what they think those people will want to hear in order to get their vote and their support and gain office. And I think as Christians, we can fall into that same danger of speaking in a way that sort of says what people want to hear, and so that we're popular, we're supported, maybe we gain opportunities. And I think we just need to remember from a gospel perspective that actually we are to be spokesmen for Christ, spokesmen for God, who speak the truth, even when that truth is kind of unpalatable, even when it's not what people want to hear. And to some extent, gospel is always not what people want to hear because it's confrontational. It announces people's sin and offers them hope. So I think I think there's a lesson for us there in not falling into a political way of engaging as a pattern for gospel kind of ministry.
That's really helpful reflection, John. I think you're absolutely right. And we've got to be so careful not to do that and to make sure that we're presenting Christ as he would be presented in the scriptures, isn't it? So I think that's exactly right. Let's come to cost of living. I feel a bit like we are sleepwalking into this as a nation, that we're going to, you've said privately to me, winter's going to be horrendous. And that's what you're talking about, I'm sure. How do we respond to this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it feels like that at the moment. And I think this political vacuum in which long-term decisions can't be made is actually compounding that. So because we don't know who's going to be prime minister, it seems as though decisions can't be made. It's clear that there are very significant increases in cost, particularly of energy, that are kind of coming. And I think actually part of it is there is an expectation that government's going to have to do something. So it is going to be much harder than people have thought. Today we've been hearing about how the algorithm's going to work for the price of gas, and that the monthly bill could go up to £500 a month over the winter period. Government today has also been talking about how it's going to allocate the £400 that's already been sort of agreed to kind of defray from people's bills. So
that's a drop in the ocean, though, with the yep. thousands that's being talked about, isn't it?
It is, but I think actually that was what was decided some months ago. And I think politicians are going to have to address the issue of the cost of living crisis, and particularly the cost of energy. So at one level, I think we're in this vacuum of not knowing what they're going to do. I do think that it seems unlikely they're going to do nothing. So, I mean, there are a variety of things that they can do. They could obviously kind of remove VAT from fuel. They could subsidize the cost of fuel. They could increase the amount that they're giving to people across the board. They could significantly increase the amount that they're giving to people on lower incomes to insulate them against the risks. Because at one level, fuel inflation seems to be not a long-term thing, but a relatively short-term issue that's a result of the Ukraine war, the ending of the supply of gas from the sort of from Russia, that the finding of alternative supplies and sources. So this may well be a kind of a short, medium-term problem. And just as the government put immense financial resources into supporting people through the pandemic, I suspect there'll be the same kind of pressure on government to do that. So I think the challenge at this point is we don't know what government will do, but I can't imagine anybody becoming prime minister in September saying it's fine, we're not going to do anything more. Certainly not if they have any kind of intention of winning an election in a few years' time. So I think we're in this kind of hiatus of not knowing. So it may well be that government has to step in with much greater intervention and support. Inevitably, at the moment, people are really worried because they don't know that that will be the case. And it's still going to be hard in terms of increased costs for people. And there's what government can do. Within churches, we're going to have members of our churches who are struggling because of this. This is one of those times at which that biblical principle of those who having much sharing those who have less becomes really, really relevant. I think in many of our church contexts, we actually really haven't had to share sort of money with one another particularly because there haven't been crises like this that have affected kind of many members of our congregations, those who are kind of working and in jobs. Maybe it will be an opportunity for us as churches to consider how we can genuinely sort of help those who are in need. And we need to find ways that enable people to speak about their need and that enable sort of resources to be targeted to them. So maybe churches need to be thinking about setting up hardship funds that will be available. That's one of the key roles, of course, of deacons in the life of the church in the Bible, is that distribution of sort of resources to those who are in need. And maybe this will highlight the massive importance of diaconal ministry in the life of churches. Of course, churches are going to face the problem of their own increased bills as well. So actually sort of commercial energy prices are not protected in the way that residential prices are. So actually there will be big hits often for churches and organizations in terms of heating their own buildings. I was speaking to some church leaders this week who were just beginning to think about whether they might open up their building to the public in some way and see this as an opportunity. That maybe if they heat their building, will people from the community be able to come in and spend time there during the day? Maybe they could provide a work hub that people who work from home could come and be in the church building rather than having to pay for their own heating, that people in the local community could come in for tea and coffee and be somewhere warm. There actually might be some opportunities for churches to become places that people can come to so that they're not having to, as it were, spend the cost on heating their own home because they can come and be somewhere which is warm and where they're made welcome. So maybe there might be some opportunities in those ways for churches to demonstrate care and care for their community.
Some of the front pages this morning have got pictures of energy bosses, energy firms having announced billions of pounds in profit. I mean, this might be my left wing coming out, but that doesn't look good, does it?
Well, it doesn't. But I mean, at one level, that's again a result of the market. If the wholesale prices go up, their costs haven't actually changed. So much bigger profits is an inevitable result of that. So at one level, that's actually a consequence of the market. It's not because they've done something necessarily to earn those profits. And I think that the challenge there has been whether or not there should be some kind of windfall tax on them. So again, that's part of the political debate. So the government had said they were going to have a windfall tax on the energy companies. Liz Truss has said she doesn't want a windfall tax.
Haven't they done that already? Have I dreamt that?
No, I think it's been announced, but I don't think it's been applied yet. But I mean, obviously, there have been situations in the past where because of the wider economic circumstances, certain industries or businesses generate profits that are unexpectedly large, not as a result of their efforts, but just because of the changed environment. Actually, at those points, governments have stepped in and have said those profits ought to be taken to be used to support the people affected. So, for example, when the Labour government came in 1997, I think there was a windfall tax then on the privatised utilities. There have been windfall taxes on the banks when they've enjoyed extraordinary profits because of just very high interest rates. So there is a precedent for government sort of recognizing that those profits are not legitimately earned, but are simply a result of the wider circumstances and in effect to redistribute them.
Thanks, John. Let's move on to talk about the Tavistock Centre. So this is the gender identity clinic in London, which had been subject of an investigation after whistleblowing, I think, took place in terms of the way children were being encouraged to change their gender. Announced yesterday by the NHS that they're going to close it. So first of all, reaction to that, John?
Well, in many ways, this is extraordinary. The Tavistock Clinic has been at the forefront of transgender kind of ideology, of treating those with gender dysphoria, of encouraging particularly the use of a kind of puberty blockers with teenagers who are kind of raising issues of their gender identity. So they had been, as it were, the leaders in this entire area, but they've been subject to sustained complaint, inspections by the NHS that have been increasingly critical. And now to be shut down is, I think, an indication that there is a recognition of something fundamentally wrong in the way that those who are presenting with gender identity issues are being treated. So one of the major criticisms against them is that this treatment, particularly kind of using puberty blockers, is entirely experimental. Nobody knows what the long-term impact of that is. They've been criticized because there are questions of giving puberty blockers. Does that stop people passing through the normal hormonal experience of puberty in which gender identity may well settle? So in a sense, it prevents the body itself kind of coming through that period. So at one level, it kind of exacerbates the problem rather than addressing the problem. There's some sort of kind of criticism being raised of the way that the use of puberty blockers might affect the development of the brain during a very important period. So what seems to be emerging here is that what has been allowed is an ideological treatment that might be actually very damaging to the children that have experienced it. So I think these criticisms are incredibly significant. Mm. They're a recognition of the danger of pursuing an ideology at the expense of a genuine investigation of the science, the impact. Now, what's going to happen is that this London clinic is going to be replaced by a sort of a series of regional kind of clinics. So at one level, it will be argued that services are still going to be provided and provided more easily across the country. And at one level, Stonewall has kind of welcomed that and seen it almost as a positive thing.
Well, that was their take. It was an interesting spin, wasn't it? So they basically said, oh, this is good because, you know, all these thousands of children that need help will now be able to be helped regionally rather than having a centre. So they've managed to spin it in that direction, which is interesting. So this treatment isn't going to stop, would be Stonewall's argument.
I think that's right. And there are some individuals who struggle with gender dysphoria where sort of some kind of treatment is an appropriate thing to consider and investigate. But the bigger point is that actually the whole clinical approach that's been adopted with this kind of mass sort of use of medication for kind of prepubescent teenagers presenting with gender identity issues, that itself is being critiqued and being critiqued by medical kind of professionals. And I think that this is part of a bigger picture of how the whole transgender kind of ideology and its impact is being increasingly critiqued by wider society. So we're seeing that in relation to women's sport, the increasing numbers of sporting bodies deciding that sort of transgender women cannot compete in women's sport because they have an inbuilt sort of physical advantage. There was an extraordinary story in the paper last week about an American kind of transgender woman who had been put into a women's prison and has now been removed after fathering three children while they were in the prison there. And actually a survey by YouGov fairly recently just indicated that public attitudes towards transgenderism are changing, that the numbers of people who are happy with the idea that you're a woman because you say you're a woman, that has shifted quite significantly in the recent period, so that a smaller percentage of people are sort of accepting that as an appropriate sort of statement. And I think this just represents a kind of a shift. And in many ways, I'm not surprised by that. So transgender ideology has been kind of the new thing. I don't think it's unlike the sexual revolution that took place in the 1960s and the 1970s. You have a sudden change in kind of society's understandings, and then you get a whole variety of extreme positions that emerge from that. So it's forgotten that in the early 1970s, as part of the sexual revolution, there were groups that were kind of advocating paedophilia as being positive. It was being promoted. And actually what happens is those extreme movements emerge early. And then they begin to be subject to significant criticism. And in a sense, there has to be a reining back.
Interesting, with Tavistock, though, that this is almost kind of state-sponsored. So this is an NHS clinic paid for by the taxpayer. This is not an extreme group. This is actually mainstream, isn't it?
Well, it's mainstream, but it's driven by an ideology. And I think that the NHS has had to respond to that ideology. And as with every new innovation and new approach, it takes time for a counter-narrative to be developed, for the research to be done. So we're only beginning to see the numbers of people who, for example, are now regretting having taken puberty blockers, who have become comfortable with their kind of biological sort of sex and gender, and are now saying, I have been mistreated and abused by this system. So yes, it is sponsored by the NHS, but they've bought into the ideology. But it's only at a later stage that you begin to have sort of the evidence mounting up of the negative consequences. Actually, that's a warning to us sometimes of jumping onto bandwagons.
Yeah.
And I think, again, Christians can easily do that. We can do that in relation to, for example, theological movements or new claims that are being made. I think, for example, of the new perspective on Paul and a whole load of people who jumped onto the bandwagon of allegedly new understandings of justification by faith. And then sort of what happens is a set of scholars begin to do work. They begin to critique those views. They begin to show that they're not well-founded. And you begin to get a kind of a moving back to a more orthodox position. And I think that is what's happening really in relation to transgenderism.
Last week, John, you were away in Boston for a couple of days. I think you were just a few miles from where the record temperature was recorded of 40.3 degrees, I think, in part of Lincolnshire. And I noticed this morning that BBC had an article saying that their weather presenters had been attacked on social media for basically linking the extreme heat to climate change. There is a debate there for Christians to have. I guess my question is, if we look at the temperatures last week and we talk about climate change, are we just being woke? Are we just bowing to a secular agenda? I mean, there'll be people listening who will be asking those questions, I think, and have people in their congregations asking those questions. How do we respond to this?
I think that's been a debate that's been going on for some decades. And actually, at one level, you could say that those are the highest temperatures we've had ever, but there were temperatures that were not unlike that in 1976, which is quite some time ago. And so those who want to deny global warming will say this is just something that happens from time to time. I do think, though, that there is an overwhelming body of evidence that shows that on average, temperatures are increasing. It seems difficult to deny that, and it seems that fewer and fewer people are denying that there is a kind of a global climate change that is a result of human activity. So average temperatures are rising. There was some sort of research this week that was showing that spring is coming sort of earlier, and there is evidence that sea levels are rising at a much faster rate. So they've been rising for the better part of the last century. At the beginning of the century, they were rising by about 1.5 millimeters a year. They're now rising by about 5 millimeters a year. So it seems undeniable that the climate is kind of changing, and that is having an impact. So I would want to say that as Christians, it comes back to something we were saying about a moment ago, that you have to take on board the evidence. And it seems that the evidence is increasingly overwhelming that there is a kind of climate change. Now, there are some people who dispute whether that's the result of human activity or whether there are other factors. I think the overwhelming consensus seems to be that this is the result of some kind of human activity in the way that we're kind of using the Earth's resources. The big question then becomes what ought to be the response to that? How important is it? Is this a sort of an apocalyptic catastrophe that, you know, in a sense is the greatest challenge facing humanity? Is that the category in which to put it? And what is the appropriate response to it?
But interestingly, the response of some Christians would be to say, well, Christ will return. He'll recreate everything anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I think that would be a naive view, and it's not really a view that the Bible takes. I do think from a Christian perspective, we need to recognize that we do have a responsibility to the world in which we've been placed. God designed this earth to be a habitat for humanity. And actually, we've got to avoid two dangers. On the one hand, there's the kind of extreme environmentalist view that basically says that mankind is a parasite on kind of nature. No, the book of Genesis says that we were created to be God's representatives and God's rulers. Mm. We were to fill and subdue, which is to bring the earth into productive cultivation, and the spreading of humanity across the earth was God's plan and purpose. So an anti-development, anti kind of agriculture, anti-growth view for its own sake doesn't fit with the biblical principle at all. At the same time, the Bible itself talks about our environmental responsibility and recognizes that in a sense, in a flawed world that is a result of sin, the earth is fragile, and therefore we have a responsibility to appropriately steward it. So that might be in our farming methods. There's biblical material about the way that we are to, for example, preserve fruit trees, because there's a recognition that you can actually take the asset now, but actually that's just short-term thinking, and it doesn't provide for the future. So I'm not convinced that, biblically speaking, our Christian mission is to save the earth in that sense. But actually, at a level of common grace and the kind of covenant of creation that was established, we have a responsibility to steward appropriately the place where God has created for us. And it seems to me that as Christians, That ought to be part and parcel of our kind of living in this world.
Mm. We'll do it imperfectly now, but we'll do it perfectly when Christ returns. So.
And of course, the idea that, you know, we're just, it's all going to burn eventually when Christ returns. Well, at one level, what we don't know is how long that will be. Mm. We don't know what God's purposes are with the Lord. A day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. I think, there were Christians in the first century who you might have said, well, it doesn't matter, the Lord's about to return. And of course, 2,000 years later, we're still waiting for the return of the Lord Jesus. And only when his purpose, in effect, of saving the great multitude that cannot be numbered has been accomplished, will he bring this present world to its end and bring about a glorious new creation. So I think it's naive to simply say, we don't have to take any responsibility for the longer term future. And that's true, actually, in our personal lives. And that's true on a bigger scale as well.
John, you mentioned things coming to an end. One thing that's come to an end as we come into land on this podcast is Neighbours. Final episode, I think, is being shown this week, 38 years of the Australian soap. And John, I think you've got quite a personal connection to this soap, haven't you? Just outline that for us.
Neighbours, that kind of takes me back, and there's a load of nostalgia. I was about 17 when Neighbours first came onto the BBC. And I have to say, me and my friends, we were kind of addicted to Neighbours at that stage. So I think for a number of years, it was a kind of a daily ritual of watching Neighbours and watching what's happening. People might find this hard to believe, but it was kind of like Friends sort of 10 years later. It had that side of sort of impact on our youth culture at that particular point.
A six-year-old me missed Scott and Charlene's wedding and I cried in our lounge. So there we are.
Yeah, no, funny enough, actually the lady who played Beverly Marshall, who was one of Jim Robinson's kind of wives. She was the local GP.
One of his wives. Make you sound like Henry VIII.
Well, over 38 years, there have been quite a number of relationships he's sort of had. But actually, she was my cousin. So it was a sort of a slight kind of very minor claim to fame when the series burst. I've never met her. And she was kind of, they'd moved to Australia years before. But she was, in fact, my cousin playing that role. Although she only stuck in it for 18 months and was replaced by somebody else. But I do think it was an extraordinary phenomenon that here was this kind of Australian soap opera that kind of gripped the imagination, particularly of, I think, kind of younger people and teenagers. And I find it almost impossible to believe that it's been 38 years and that it has run for that long. I haven't followed it for pretty much the last 36 years. But for a couple of years, I think we were rather obsessional about kind of watching Neighbours, and not just Neighbours, but then its impact on pop music as sort of Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue were kind of brought in by Stock Aitken and Waterman and kind of dominated the charts in the late 1980s. I mean, it had a massive cultural impact, really.
Why was it so popular?
Yeah, I think a number of things. As I reflect on it, I think it offered a vision of life that we were really attracted to, and a better life. It's hard to imagine what the early 1980s were like. And I hear the Conservative candidates kind of channeling Margaret Thatcher, but my memory of the early 1980s is that it was a pretty grim time. It was a grim time of mass unemployment. Mm. It was a pretty grey time. Actually, it was also the height of the Cold War. And I think we lived under the shadow of some kind of a potential nuclear apocalypse. They were kind of bringing in kind of cruise missiles. SS-20s were being located in kind of in Eastern Europe. So it felt a time in which life felt fragile and fairly grim. And I think in terms of the soap operas that were available at that stage, on the one hand, you had the American soap operas, which kind of focused on the uber rich.
It was Dallas.
Kind of Dallas and Dynasty were kind of big. And then you had the British soap operas, which tended to be pretty grim and gritty. So you had by that stage, Coronation Street, EastEnders, and they were kind of kitchen sink dramas of kind of pretty grim life, actually. So you had this irony of an American vision of kind of ultra-rich life that was beyond anybody's imagination, or you had a rather grim, almost enjoying looking at other people's lives that were more difficult than yours. And I think Neighbours came into the middle of that with a very different vision, which was of an ordinary life. So the people were basically ordinary, but it was in a hot, sunny environment. They were clearly enjoying themselves. I think it communicated something about community. So I think the very idea of neighbours and the kind of the relationships between the people was a really attractive picture. And I think for those of us living in Britain at that time, that was a life and a lifestyle that seemed really attractive. And maybe we naively assumed that that was what it was really like in Australia. But it was part of a bigger thing, actually, part of an Australian cultural influx. I mean, one of the big films of the time was kind of Crocodile Dundee, and that whole kind of world of a more relaxed life that was materially comfortable and in warmth was just hugely attractive to us. And I think it sat in this place as a life could be better. Mm. And I think that's really interesting because it touches on sort of some really deep human longings. We have a longing for that kind of better life. And I think sometimes we think that better life has got to be something extreme, like the Dallas or the Dynasty. But no, but actually what most people want is something like their own lives, only kind of better, warmer. And I think it reveals something of the kind of the human longing for that connectedness and community. And in many ways, that's what the church ought to be offering people. The real hope for that is found in the gospel. I mean, one of my memories of kind of Neighbours is that kind of Wicked Witch character was Mrs. Mangle, if anybody remembers her. And she was the Christian. Mm. And actually, again, that, you know, I wasn't a Christian at the time, but again, that was quite striking that you've got all these people kind of enjoying kind of life and being together. And the one killjoy, hypocrite, is presented as the Christian. And I think in some ways that also reveals the sort of a secular critique of kind of religion. And sadly, that confirmed the prejudice that a lot of people have. And we've got to overcome that prejudice and show in our churches, in our engagement with people, that is not what Christianity is. It is not empty, hypocritical ritual. It is a life of genuine community and hope.
John Stevens on Neighbours. Thank you very much, dear brother. Good to talk about what's been happening in the news this week. Thank you for joining us on Independence, the FREC podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please rate it or leave a review so other people can find it, and we'll speak to you again soon. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Phil.